Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever time you're listening. A little reminder, we are all connected. Welcome back to the Storytelling for Social Impact podcast. I have another wonderful guest this week. This is the podcast where we share insights and learnings from different experiences that our guests and I have around storytelling for social impact. We talk about campaigns that really worked well and why, and other campaigns that didn't work so well. And of course, all embedded within the broader experience of each of our guests in terms of trying to affect positive change in the world and the role storytelling can play in that. This week's guest is Sana Kapadia. She has been involved in finance and impact and the cross-section of these things, also intersecting with gender and climate for many, many years. One of the things we talked about on this episode is intersectionality and how everything is connected, and how as much as it's great to be embedded in a particular SDG or a particular sector or a particular mission within our work, it's important to also realize how everything has a knock-on effect on each other and how everything really, really is connected. So lots of really interesting stuff. Join me and let's dive right in. Sana, lovely to see you. It's been a while.
Great to see you too, Rob. It has been a while. How was your summer?
It was nice, actually. Yeah, we had a very warm summer in the UK this year. It was a scorcher. How about you? You're in Dubai, but I guess it's always a bit hot, is it?
It's always a bit hot, always.
That's the one thing about the UK. We definitely have seasons. Yeah. You know, it's quite clearly defined, whereas, yeah, in some other places, less so, I think, isn't it?
Hot and less hot.
Yeah. So we met through the mighty Suzanne Beagle 6-7 years ago, obviously with the work around gender smart investing and then 2X and so on. So have you always, give us a little bit of idea about your background. Have you always been in finance, or then how did you come into impact stuff?
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity, Rob. So I was reflecting on this recently. When I was about 7 or 8, I wanted to be an archaeologist. I have always loved writing and poetry and could have been a journalist, but then somehow I found my feet in finance. I did an undergrad in business and also found it fascinating and lots to learn and pick up. And I started my career in equity research and sort of broader corporate finance. But within 5 years of having a fabulous career, I decided that I needed to go find something that felt more aligned. And that's how I found my path into impact investing. And I've been there for the last, gosh, now, I think if you do the math, more than 15 years.
The numbers keep going up, don't they?
They sure do. They sure do. And then you look back and where did the time go? Yeah. And then on the way of being in the impact space, I found my world in gender lens investing and then gender and climate finance. And that's where I've been for a while now and continue to see the importance.
I was just looking on your LinkedIn profile and you talk about intersectionality. And obviously there's layers to that. Just putting finance with anything else in some respects is intersectionality in the beginning, like finance and gender, finance and climate. Whereas if you go back maybe 40 years or so, finance was not really connected to impact. It was just simply about making money and that was it, and whatever the sort of business field was. Now, as you say, you've got gender and climate as another intersectionality and so on. I guess as we gradually come to realize that everything is connected and has an effect on each other thing, right?
I have a few theories on why some of this takes shape the way it does. And maybe some of those archaeology-based dreams and being a history buff. I love to read a lot of nonfiction, and there's some amazing books out there that talk about the origin of economics, the origin of money, the origin of patriarchy, etc. And I think so much of the way we have current systems is also based on not acknowledging, not valuing everybody in society in the same way, thinking of nature as something separate, and we're seeing the impact of what that means in our day-to-day. If I think back to when I studied business and economics in university, there was nothing on sustainable investing, as you rightly said. But it's not like these things haven't been interconnected right from the beginning of time. It's just how we teach economics, how we teach business, how we teach finance. It's easy to commodify and put things into different buckets, but they're absolutely interconnected. And as investors, it's been my experience that it's important to really understand from a more sort of holistic way in which we should be thinking about risk, return, value, impact, and bring those pieces together as we make investment decisions and future-proof our portfolios.
Just a quick, I think, obviously the microphone's sitting on the desk.
Yeah.
If you are leaning on the desk or moving on the desk, it's picking up. I hate to curtail your flow, if you can try not to touch the table, that'd be awesome. I was reading something yesterday by Cillian Murphy, the actor. He was in Theory of Everything. He was in Oppenheimer.
Okay.
You know, he's a very famous leading man. He was just talking about, for him, luxury is just being at home, having very normal life, you know, having a cup of tea, reading, just being with his family. That sort of intimacy is like true luxury. Mm. Whereas obviously so much of the time, another projection of luxury is 5-star hotels, infinity pools and all of that. I found it even myself in my own life, just how money, it's a very powerful energy in and of itself, and how it kind of can influence us as we get more so-called quote unquote successful. Mm-hmm. We tend to get bigger houses, further away from other people, maybe even gates. And so a lot of the things that help us to feel connected to each other and to nature and everything else kind of almost become more and more removed as we so-called get more money and more successful. So it's just an interesting thing. It doesn't have to be like that, but so often it is like that. People in the impact space are trying to plug all these things back into that connection. But there is a strong tide, let's just say, going in the opposite direction. So what have been your experiences with that?
I loved what you were bringing up, Rob, about the luxury and value. I think if we had a very honest conversation as humans about what is my individual enough and what is our collective enough and how do we live in harmony, how different could the world look? Like, what do we all really need rather than a super unequal system that favors a few and leaves most people behind? So these are also some deeper, I think each individual, whether you're in the impact investing space or not, you need to ask yourself some hard questions about how you want to show up in the world. And also, what kind of ancestor do you want to be? Because we're all going to leave some kind of, whether or not you have children, we're all here today, we'll be gone when we're meant to be gone. And so what kind of story do you want to leave for those future generations?
For sure. And it is actually a genuinely difficult question if you're truly honest, if you ask it to yourself in a truly honest way, because I often thought that, you know, we go to gatherings and conferences and everyone, we all say our spiel and everyone has a good this, that, and the other. But in reality, would any of us be willing or want to have less? It is quite an affronting thing. I just wondered what your thoughts were about, well, maybe I'll ask you, what's the SDG that that's close to your heart?
As I said at the beginning, I focused at least the last 10 years of my career at the gender lens investing and advancing the field of gender finance. And in terms of the SDGs, that would be SDG 5, which is gender equality. It's also seen as a lever because it cuts across all the SDGs, whether it's climate action, which is my second favorite, which is SDG 13, but then equally reduced inequalities, or the first, which is no poverty, or any of them, right? So gender is really a lever. And that's part of the thesis of what gender lens investing is about. It's really seeing how you can integrate gender analysis as investors make decisions in order to not just mitigate risk, but find opportunities and unlock more value. And the stats still show that, you know, it'll take 142 years for gender parity, if not more. That's not in my lifetime, not in my daughter's lifetime, not in her daughter's lifetime, probably. And so we have our work cut out for us.
As I've been doing this new series of the podcast and asking people this, it's come up again in a number of ways. It's quite fascinating. So somebody chose access to energy. I don't remember the exact wording. And they also explained how they saw that as a sort of almost underpinning, you know, all of the others. And someone else chose partnerships. So it's so fascinating how we each tend to perhaps work more in one than the others, but they are all so much interconnected. It's kind of impossible to separate them out, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think that's the whole point that we've been double-clicking on is intersectionality. And I think the SDGs were also conceived as something multidimensional because all of these issues are interconnected. It does help, of course, for those who are, I think, more data-driven to then be able to sort of hone in on a particular SDG, look at specific indicators, sub-indicators. It helps with accountability. But of course, you need to have this more holistic mindset as your, whether it's a project, whether it's a fund, whatever your initiative might be taking forward. And at the same time, things like this provide common language, which then supports common understanding, which is also essential. So we need, and it's colorful. I think, you know, it helps that there's things that people can attach. And, you know, I remember when my daughter came home from school, maybe 3 years ago now, they brought up the SDGs in her classroom. And that was when she was in year three. So that gives me hope that our children today are being taught. I didn't study anything in business school about this. So we certainly have come a long way.
Yeah, for sure. You mentioned earlier that there's a lot of reporting, a more numbers-based approach, this many women engaged or jobs created or whatever it might be. And you sort of alluded that you felt there needed to be additional kind of ways of trying to capture that impact. So what were you thinking? Are you thinking more in terms of the human stories? How would you see it being more meaningful or more rich?
I think it has to be both quantitative and qualitative. And of course, there are many investors and also lots of initiatives that have started to balance these two approaches. Of course, have to mention 60 Decibels, which has pioneered this more community-centered, participatory way of collecting data from users of impactful products and really then being able to translate that this amount of capital went to, let's say, these many households that are able to use this solar product in this way. And by the way, the provision of training to make sure that the women households know how to use it or they know how to balance a budget, which then enables them to go and do their business and make more money. And then you're able to start to see a more rounded picture of, okay, yes, there's the investment at the front end, there's technical assistance, all these things. Yes, these many women were reached by a certain intervention, but in their own voices, being able to hear about greater capacity, confidence, feeling more secure, feeling less at danger of gender-based violence. That mix of quantitative and qualitative, I think, is really important. And with the move to sort of outcomes, I think as a field, we definitely need to be talking and reporting also if we can identify, for instance, if it's a financial inclusion project, yes, it's these many more individuals got access to a bank account, but how many of them have been using it to do something productive? Or, for instance, have we seen a reduction in domestic violence or an increase? Because we know sometimes that's the case when even though you're provided access, it actually has negative consequences. So being able to see things from multiple sides, I think, and in fact, in my opinion, it's more generative to actually know the shift that's happening over time rather than also just at one point in time. And the objective shouldn't be like fancy impact reports with lots of colors and numbers, but actually it should be just lived experience and seeing that sustained change over time.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating, actually. I remember I did my MBA research on venture philanthropy in 2008. And one of the findings was, or one of the characteristics of this venture philanthropy, if you like, as opposed to a lot of the other traditional types of philanthropy, was that it was much longer term. And I think that's part of it, isn't it? Committing to a certain type of work over a much more extended period of time. So that you can be around long enough to be patient enough to see that longer term change. Whereas when it's short term, just like the short term problems of short term reporting in traditional finance, there's so much pressure on squeezing out the numbers within that quarterly report or that annual report or whatever. You're almost not allowing for the real life is often a lot more slow, boring, messy, complicated, confusing than any of us would ever want it to be. But it's just the reality of it, you know.
Yeah.
So trying to stick with something over an extended period of time and allow for those human factors, and also to sometimes see that the change that happens is not what you wanted or predicted, but still working with that. I loved what you said about the impact being captured in their own voices. Obviously, that's not only hugely valuable because there's a sense of agency for them, but also it's like you could uncover, just in the same way that I've been listening to so many of the gender lens conversations, because we've been around it filming and stuff. And one of the things that I always found fascinating was just this idea that even if it's just this one point, that there's a whole new perspective you bring by bringing in women to look at these investments, these challenges, these products, these markets. You get a whole new way of seeing things, and it unlocks a lot of things that otherwise just would not be, not even ignored, just not even considered, you know? And so similarly, by hearing from people themselves on the ground, you get to find out stuff that, yeah, you maybe in a million years you would have never thought. But just by hearing it coming back from them.
Absolutely. And I think of it here, like maybe just to bring it to life from our Heading for Change portfolio, which has 18 climate funds that integrate gender to varying degrees. I can think of our three funds in Africa, actually. Kabasathi, which is on its second fund, and gender cuts across their entire process and thesis. But by understanding that when rolling out solar energy and household solar products, integrating women and community voices actually then enhances uptake and revenue and profitability has really been sort of key factor in one of the portfolio companies that they support. On the other side, you have the Catalyst Fund, which is also sub-Saharan Africa, and they're an earlier stage venture builder and venture fund. And for such a young fund, I'm always amazed at the depth of their impact reporting, because they work diligently with each of their portfolio companies to really identify. And they work across climate resilience, sustainable ag, and even financial resilience. So they have insurance, climate tech products. And so really demonstrating that there are many different ways to work towards mitigation, adaptation, and resilience goals through these different entry points. With technical assistance, they're able to, again, support the portfolio companies in leveling up their own gender action plans and gender metrics. And then the beauty of that whole model also is that the portfolio companies are then able to see how this is impacting business and impact growth. And so they work in tandem. And it really is demonstrating this more sort of relational model to capital. And then on the West African side, we've supported Sahara Impact Ventures, led by two African amazing GPs, general partners, who are focused more on the just transition, working with local businesses and providing that sort of really early stage capital where others are just not ready or willing to go. And then to be able to look across these three, and those are just three, the broader pipeline in Africa is much bigger. But to really be in dialogue with these managers who are then building with and from community perspectives, supporting local solutions that are context specific. In fact, I think it's both in Kawasaki, but also in Catalyst's case, Catalyst in particular, one of their portfolio companies is an Earthshot Prize finalist and focused on sort of rolling out a refrigeration solution that is enabling less food waste. So there's so many multiple dimensions as well to the impact. It might look on the surface like a particular type of business, but again, speaking of intersectionality, there's so many components, right? So being able to see that come live, that's part of the long term for us too, is to be able to, in 5 years and in 10 years, really solidify and make that case that this integrated climate and gender investing approach can support stronger climate, financial, and social outcomes.
Yeah, 100%. I just interviewed the CEO of SolarAid, Richard Turner, the other day for the podcast, and they're taking a similar approach. I know you mentioned solar quite a few times there, and obviously refrigeration and stuff. And they're a charity, so I suppose they're part of the funding pool or funding collective, I suppose. And you mentioned there are different types of funding at different stages. I think that's the thing, isn't it? Different funders will have different risk appetites and I guess different ways to contribute, I guess, to bigger goals ultimately. Because there was always a time where there may be very little apparent return in the beginning while you're sort of almost establishing the foundations for something to happen, especially in really remote developing parts of the world where there isn't really a market yet. Mm-hmm. So because it's philanthropy, they're proving that a market can be there in some of these harder to reach areas so that then the actual entrepreneurs and the other more commercial funders go, okay, well, actually we could do it.
Yeah.
Whereas previously they might have just thought it's too hard, you know?
Yeah. I think that's also relevant, for example, with some of our funds, not just in Africa, but broadly in the emerging markets, where they have tended to apply these broader ecosystem approaches. So whether it's venture building or pipeline building, and really engaging with the local early stage community to make sure that women-led, gender-diverse teams even know how to get started and get that support that they need, because it takes like really understanding some of the market failures and then trying to build from the ground up in a more systemic way that will last for a longer time. So we are seeing, especially in the emerging markets where there do tend to be more barriers to entry, et cetera, and capital markets are not necessarily as deep. And so you do need different types of capital for different stages and different programmatic work as well to really help build that pipeline and build a continuum of capital.
Yeah, 100%. Before we start to dive into more how storytelling can help us move some of these things forward, one thing you said reminded me of something I wanted to just share. You mentioned how trying to capture how sometimes the positive impacts might be that gender-based violence goes down, but equally sometimes it may also go up. So I remember whilst making my documentary, A Girl Could Touch the Sky, I interviewed Sheikha Oberoi, who was previously India's number one professional tennis player. And she shared something very powerful that's in the film, which is it's very clear. And there's a lot of energy and enthusiasm behind educating girls, obviously for good reason. But sometimes, you know, she used this phrase, you can educate a girl into isolation, because if she's in a rural situation, in a rural village, and she is now, her eyes and dreams and hopes and education is, you know, becoming expanded, but she's still in that place, you know, everyone around her, the community, the men and the women often, haven't changed, but she may have changed. Then actually she's, you know, at least temporarily, almost in a worse position, you know, because it's very difficult for her. So it's like navigating those kind of things is like I said earlier, where it'd be great if everything was just nice and clean and simple and black and white, but it's not.
No, and I think that's why the work of really understanding social norms, working on, you know, how barriers and biases show up. This is long-term work. And it takes a while for societies to change. And I think that, you know, even if you extrapolate that example into a workplace, you might have an entrepreneur or someone who's been pushing, but it really takes a while, especially in bigger institutions, for change to happen. And that's why you need community in this work so much, because you need to have those safe spaces as well as places to keep the broader field accountable too, right? So it's part of the holistic journey.
So I know you also have a podcast, you've done content previously, you have a passion for storytelling as well. What are your observations or experiences, or maybe even you have some specific campaigns you can share where you saw storytelling work really well, or also sometimes just as educational, where you really think it didn't work so well?
I'm very partial to this question because, as you know, I love to write and read and get stories out there. And for me, when I started my podcast, for example, which is on leadership, the thing I was most excited about was to get other people's stories out there. And through like these types of conversations, as you peel back the layers, you get to know someone so fully. And the amount of times I've had people reach out and say, oh, I didn't know that about that person. Or, you know, when we did this interview, I was so candid, but it was what was needed. And I think that that's the power of stories. And that's why for generations, from the beginning of time, we have leveraged stories as a way to give voice and also bring into spaces people and things that can't be there, right? And this is why that intergenerational aspect of storytelling is so important. I had fun thinking about or reflecting on this question, Robin. The one that was coming to mind for me, which sadly, I don't know why it was discontinued, but you might remember the Make My Money Matter campaign, which was UK pension funds, and they had Olivia Colman and Benedict Cumberbatch.
I do remember.
You know, like
he was in the sauna, wasn't he, in one of them. Yeah.
And then Olivia Colman is like chugging down some petroleum, basically. And then there's another actor who is in a plant shop. As people are buying plants, everything is going on fire. And the tagline is, while you're getting on with this, like, you know, the fossil fuel industry is like burning through the Amazon. So I really loved that campaign because it was obviously satirical and at the same time was getting across some key messages. More recently, I have appreciated Project Dandelion and the way it has built on voices of community leaders and also high-profile leaders such as Merritt Robinson, who's one of the founders of the movement. And the framing there is also really elegant, right? It's every issue is a climate issue. And then you go in and look and see how, again, some of these things are so intersectional, women's health, food security, all the things. So I think those are some more recent ones. And then maybe an older one, and this, I'm assuming it could still be a campaign, but I remember a couple of years ago, there was an Always campaign on Like a Girl.
Yes.
And it was run like a girl, hit like a girl, all the things. And that speaks, I think, to like the social coding of what we said a girl or a boy should be. So,
yes.
Yeah, I find it's usually the campaigns that stick with you are the ones that are concise. There's something sensational maybe in ways too. It gets you thinking, it triggers something for you. You want to share it immediately with people that you know. I guess sometimes the star factor helps too. Like you'll never forget Olivia Colman, like sipping her gasoline basically. So. And at the same time, they're serious. They're talking about serious things, right? So it's a different way of getting across a key message that will stick with you. And hopefully you'll get people who are not in your circle to also learn about it.
That's a big point, actually. Yeah, outside the bubble.
Right now, that's feeling even more important because, you know, thinking about impact investing, thinking about gender lens investing, we've been in our own rooms and spaces and we've made a ton of progress, but it's still billions and trillions compared to the over 150 trillion in sort of broader finance flows. So we do have a long way to go. And at the same time, we have to make sure that we don't sacrifice breadth for depth. It has to be both.
Those are brilliant campaigns. I remember them well, and they're memorable because they're different. They're funny often. There's humor. The ideas are clever in and of themselves, but obviously they put their money where their mouth was. They spent a lot of money as well to make, to invest in these things. I think often it's a challenge, whether it's in the charity sector or in any sort of impact sector, there's that sense that it's sometimes the poor cousin of the commercial arm of things. And so there's always, you know, tighter budgets and everything else. And when you see somebody committing what would be a typical budget for the purely money making commercial stuff, for the impact stuff, you know, it doesn't always pay off. But in that, those instances, it really paid off. It was very powerful, far reach and very memorable and so on. But one of the things I think that worked very well and does work particularly well for social impact stuff, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. I think there's a perception that sometimes impact stuff can be a bit stuffy, a bit do-goody, a bit kind of too taking itself too seriously, which I think is probably sometimes true. And so I think that kind of funny satirical approach where it's almost like a little bit laughing at it, but at the same time, it has packs a really hard punch behind that. Is very effective, you know. because I think it's a bit like when your parents, when you're young and they want to give you a, you know, a chat, they would have a chat with you. And they're everything about what they're trying to approach you with is really like genuine and important and serious and everything. But as a teenager, you just do not want to hear it. Oh, here we go. It's like, you're going to give me a lecture. You're going to tell me what I should be doing. And I think sometimes with things like impact and stuff, we all know deep down that these things are important and they're serious. But I think sometimes they can feel too serious, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I feel like the dark side of how that then plays out is that a lot of people in the impact space and broader charity philanthropy space, they're very burnt out because there's so much that people put into the work and it starts to feel much larger than life, which it is. It is important, but it also has to be done in balance. I think though, and again, I maybe go back to another comment about, I feel maybe we're also holding ourselves to much higher standards in the impact space, because unless it's perfect, is it going to be right? And other broader mainstream strategies just will have maybe a very half-baked way of doing that and still be able to roll it out, right? So there is that sort of honest conversation to be had about, again, how much is enough, how much is right, and what really needs to be said in this moment, and have candid conversations about, hey, this is what we're not doing well, and maybe we need to stop doing X. Maybe not put this amount of money into this type of thing, because actually it could be better used for something else. Like even when it comes to impact reporting, if I think about, let's say the managers in our own portfolio, you know, on average, people have, let's say, 15, 20 other limited partners, right? Depending on the stage and all of that. So all those investors have their own reporting requirements and needs, and it has to be more bespoke and nuanced depending on what they're trying to say than to their own investors. Yeah. And that just feels like, yes, it's important, but my question then is, well, to what end? What are we going to do with this data? For all the data, let's say that even in a fund you're collecting on gender, other social impact, how are you then leveraging that to make better decisions? So that needs to be, and maybe then we can ease ourselves of some of the doing it all. But it's both. I think it's also holding others to account for the things that maybe they're not doing as well, and hopefully that we can kind of meet in the middle.
Hope you've been enjoying the series. Let us know which were your favorite episodes or what points really stood out for you. We have a new series which will be coming up just after the summer, and I have some really great guests for you. In the meantime, or anytime, as always, if you are looking to get more clarity on your story and make a greater impact in the world, whether that's through events, campaigns, or brand films, animations, podcasts, please do get in touch with us at Be Inspired Films, and we look forward to supporting you to making a greater positive impact in the world. Thank you so much. Back to the podcast. No, it's such a very deep point. It has a lot of sort of parallels. In other words, examining where are those drives to be held to a higher standard coming from? Are they just because we want to do it a better way and show an example or whatever? Of course, I'm sure that's there. Yeah. But also, I think sometimes if you're whatever the group is, if you're in the sort of group that maybe feels it needs to prove itself more because it's not the mainstream group, then it's a lot of times out of fear or the need to be accepted that we put these pressures on ourselves to be perfect or whatever. I have to do 10 times better to be accepted. And so I think that'll be an interesting thing to look at as a sector, you know, just almost to have the confidence to go, we're going to do this our own way. We're going to decide what's best for us and not let other people decide what we have to be or don't have to be. Or do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's a very difficult thing because that happens to us on an individual basis. And that's hard.
Yeah.
But let's say the same dynamics, the same power dynamics or interpersonal dynamics happen on a personal level and a community level, even on a sector level, especially I think when I've often toyed and being curious about this idea of the poor cousin. You know, there's always the feeling that, like you say, in a mainstream finance setting, that no one questions it. Like, oh, well, we're just going to, especially in a VC setting, you know, we're going to like just invest. We'll be as reckless as we want to be. We'll invest in 20 things and we know half of them just not ain't going to work and we don't care and no one questions it. But there's almost like you can't really, that would be looked on probably very differently when it's more, the social impact is there because your eyes are much more open to the impact of that, like the human cost to the ones that don't work out. Whereas that's often overlooked in a purely financial model. So as you say, there's probably somewhere in the middle where we do need to have a different set of metrics because we're trying to do it differently. But equally, we don't have to be perfect because nothing's perfect.
Yeah.
You know,
I think the only thing I would add there is that at the same time, we have to be cautious to not let impact slide into a concessionary only bucket. It needs to, because even if you look, I think, at the GIN report, they always ask this question, how many are willing to have less than market returns? And it's like less than 20%. So it's just being mindful of where that fits across the spectrum. Now, I think we could ask ourselves, well, what do we mean by market rate returns? And then also, you know, if you think about basic cash flow models, what's the discount rate that's applied? Like who's, what's the risk-free rate? Really like the, given our geopolitics right now, the world has really shifted and will continue to shift. So is it really riskier to invest in South Asia, Southeast Asia, the, you know, MENA region where there's so much innovation happening, where governments are leapfrogging technology? It's just exploding in ways that are unimaginable. Is that really risky? Or does it justify the sort of B-grade sovereign seal and all these other things? So I think that's a deeper reckoning that needs to be had in the systems in which we operate. And yes, give ourselves grace that being able to talk both quantitatively and qualitatively just provides more richness. And the human experience is not one that we can distill down to numbers. It's always been about numbers and more. Probably the numbers came after the stories. So
in the beginning, because before it was at scale, I guess it would have been, if you imagine something on a very local level originally, the numbers would have been there, but the human and the stories would have been very visible because perhaps these investors are living in the same community. They can see it, you know. It's not like you're trying to report from the other side of the globe or, you know. So what that is the interesting thing, isn't it? Let's say, you know, Indonesia or anywhere where there's a developing market. If you're a hard-nosed investor, you're going to think, okay, yeah, well, I can see there's clearly perhaps advantage there because things are growing fast. But equally, you know, as impact investors or let's just say as people in the broader field of impact, yes, I respect and appreciate that you're doing things differently because you're also trying to see the interconnectedness, you know, see the longer term, more holistic view. And you're also trying to unlock like real genuine value beyond just the numbers. But maybe is there any data that shows there's a sort of like in traditional investment, there's a J curve, right? We're not going to make money for a long time because we're investing and then we're going to make money. So equally, I wonder if there's any research or anything in the impact space where it's like, yeah, because we are doing things differently and we're taking maybe additional layers of consideration, maybe the facts are that we're going to have to, in the short term, there is a cost to that. But longer term, you know, because it's easy to promise everything. Oh, we can do everything. We can do, we can make all the money and we can do all the impact and stuff. But obviously, if you're going to put more layers in, there, you know, maybe in the short term that will slow you down a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I also think it's fair because if you think, for example, about some of the climate funds, they, you know, their vintage is 2019, 2020, and so they're going to take some time before we're going to really be able to see the full scale of financial and social impact. But at the same time, I think, and I'm sure, again, I refer to the GIN report, but there are also what's, I think, how our sector has really matured and evolved
you're seeing more region-specific reporting, right? So within the African impact investing community, for example, I think just last month it was Aruba Capital that came out with its sort of report for both GPs and LPs with some clear recommendations in the African context. These are the things that we're observing. These are the trends that gender smart businesses are demonstrating, you know, greater revenue, greater profitability, et cetera. So there's lots of local research like that. I think as an example, my mind was also going to with Swift Capital and some of the work they're doing in Southeast Asia. They've just partnered with the Australian government on the Kinetic program focused on Indonesia, where they're going to be supporting climate smart and gender smart businesses. But it takes that, again, more holistic approach. They're going to be really understanding, again, setting a baseline and then being able to see how those businesses evolve. So we have to start somewhere. And what excites me are these more regional, local, context-specific initiatives and research, where then we can start to see, all right, this, you know, in this region, actually, venture capital doesn't make sense. They need more impact-linked finance or revenue-based finance or debt, et cetera. It's these types of businesses that are trying to set up. So it requires nuance and it requires context, I think, to really get the full picture of what's working and what's not working and what's needed.
Yeah, no, that's a great point about context. And because I think sometimes there's a tendency, isn't there, to copy and paste. This is the model that we think works, so we'll just do the same thing here or wherever. And it might not be right for the place, but it also might not be right just for the timing of where things are at that point in time, right? Hope you've been enjoying the series. Let us know which were your favorite episodes or what points really stood out for you. We have a new series which will be coming up just after the summer. And I have some really great guests for you. In the meantime, or any time, as always, if you are looking to get more clarity on your story and make a greater impact in the world, whether that's through events, campaigns, or brand films, animations, podcasts, please do get in touch with us at Be Inspired Films. And we look forward to supporting you to making a greater positive impact in the world. Thank you so much. Back to the podcast.
On that point, like, I'm reminded of a number of years ago now when at our last Gender Smart Summit, when Sandrine Dixon Duclair did her 8-night speech, and one of the things that she talked about was like shared prosperity, right? And just the inequality divide, etc. And so, again, full circle for me is like, if we can really ask ourselves, as investors, as community leaders, as stakeholders, like, what is truly enough? And I think we'll end up with a very different understanding of, you know, like right now, the way we measure GDP is that it doesn't take into account the invisible work that women do. The entire care economy is excluded. Accounting standards don't reflect nature and climate. So some of the plumbing also needs to shift in order to be able to reframe these things that so many impact leaders are imagining and envisioning. But if we don't have, you know, the actual infrastructure that reflects some of this thinking in more practical ways, it becomes then harder to implement. But thankfully, there are these people tirelessly working to build new standards, recommend different actions, etc. And I think if we keep going down this pathway, even in the face of headwinds, things will look different in our space. And hopefully shared prosperity and better gender equality and all of the things is within reach.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting. I feel like it's the hidden cost. It's like we're starting to measure some of the previously invisible or hidden costs. I could say in my own experience, it's not just because it's the right thing to do. These hidden costs do become more apparent along the way too, and they can be genuine risks. Like, so say for example, with the cost on nature and ecosystems and all of that, like maybe for a period you seem to get away with it, or it looks like you're getting away with it, but then as it starts to crack, and you know, the impacts, you know, can be huge. And even within a family, if you are not acknowledging and appreciating, like I say, all of the tireless work that goes into, often by women, in the household, then sooner or later that will come out. You'll feel it. And so actually it's better for everybody to be, I would say, growing in our awareness, our understanding, our capacity to, not to sound wishy-washy, but like to embrace others beyond just ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, whether that's in the family, in the community, in society, in general. So it's almost like as a collective, we're kind of on this journey of personal growth.
Yeah.
And every time you have to make that next step, it is painful. It is hard.
Humans hate
but
change.
The alternative is not so good.
Humans hate change, and yet we have to. I mean, I think it was last year that one of the big insurance companies came out with this report that basically said a 2-degree world was uninsurable. If we go on this trajectory, 2/3 of global GDP would be lost by 2050. So to your point, there's a cost of inaction. I don't think that people have fully internalized what that world will feel like, let alone look like. Talking about climate migration, refugees, strife, increased inequality, all the things. But when the insurance companies say, hey, we're not going to be able to insure this, just think about homeowners all around the world and everything. So there are so many far-reaching consequences. And at the same time, absolutely change is hard. But it's climate change, for example, is viscerally impacting all of us in different ways. I think about like not just what will future generations ask what we did, but more so, why didn't you or what didn't you, right? Because right now, if we all collectively and individually don't use the power that we have in this moment, it's, you know, it's going to be a lost opportunity for change. I don't want that to be the narrative that we leave behind. And I know that many of us don't. So that's why we keep showing up even when we're tired to keep doing this work with bigger, because it is important. And I think every small action counts, right? So sometimes I have, as you can imagine, my kids are quite activist in their own rights. And so my daughter was asking, she's just become a scuba diver and she loves the oceans and everything. And she was saying, Mom, like I'm 10 now, will it really matter if I become a marine biologist? But you know, like what will the world look like? What will the ocean look like? And we reflect and talk about how that even if she thinks she's only 10, she has what she needs in this moment to, you know, join a school project, tell her friends about why this matters. And I can just imagine what she'll be like when she's in her 20s with the tools, the knowledge, the resources. So I think each of us needs to really understand that we have power and we can use our influence in whatever way makes sense, whether it's through our consumption. I think that's the thing about capital. It's not just our role as investors, but as consumers and the choices that we make, that's a huge lever for change, and our everyday practices too.
Yeah, that's huge, isn't it? It's like the example that's often given, you know, the cobbler, his children or her children don't have fixed shoes, or the pastor who's up there preaching away, but he's not practicing in his own life. Like, you know, I think that's something that struck me very hard oftentimes going to so many of these things, is that, like I say, it's easy to talk a good talk, but unless each of us individually in our own lives actually make some changes, then it's... have you any final thoughts on that, about how sometimes we can slip into being so, you know, obsessed about what's going on out there and, you know, all the rest of it, and actually it's hard to personally change?
I mean, I do think that the environment in which we currently live and which our younger generation is being raised... You know, if you were born the 2000s onwards, you do not know a world where there is no iPhone or the equivalent, right? A smartphone. And that generation, I think, is, and you know, going forward as well, there's this culture of now, and not necessarily fully understanding, you know, where things come from or how things used to be. So we really have to be even more intentional. But equally for the generation that came before, and I've had many friends say this to me, that their parents or older people in their families, they're like, oh, but it's not, I'll be gone. I don't need to do anything about some of this. So I do think that it really is like a deep inner connection that we do need to cultivate. We need to ground ourselves. We have this beautiful planet. Last night there was a full moon and a lunar eclipse that was visible in the UAE where I live. It was extraordinary. And my daughter insisted on staying up to watch it. It was just, you were completely mesmerized. And I always ask myself in that moment, or even just if you go for a walk in a forest, just feeling that connection, that rootedness with life in all its forms around you. We all have that. We're all, you know, humans are also nature. We're mammals. We just need to like really tap into that inner being in a different way. And I think it's mind, heart, soul connection that has to be revived. My biggest bugbear is the smartphone, because I think it's allowing us to just be plugged into an alternative system in real, and it's by intention, right? So just as it is easy to like be in that, I think sort of imagine what it would look like to switch all of that off. And if everyone just suddenly woke up and felt and experienced what was really happening, I think right now it's really easy to deflect, to be thinking, you know, to be in a different world, because it's really painful. And as we said, change is painful. But to appreciate, and I don't remember who exactly quoted this, but one of my colleagues shared at a conference she was at, as investors, we have to understand that there are no returns on a finite planet. Yeah. What could it mean to really internalize that notion and go back to the roots of what capital is supposed to be? It's a tool, it's a conduit. You know, this work is meant to be a conduit for change. As impact leaders, you know, we, as you said, shouldn't take ourselves too seriously all the time, and yet we should celebrate how we've been able to really put front and center these more sort of holistic community approaches. But I fundamentally think that we need to wake up, we need to hear the stories, we need to feel what's really happening. And once you live those, it's really hard to unsee once you've seen and felt. And that's what it will take, I think, to have more of a seismic shift. Hopefully not too overwhelming all at once, but we have to start somewhere.
Yeah, those are some very powerful statements. A 2% increase in climate is an uninsurable planet. I mean, that's super powerful. And then, you know, there are no returns on a planet that's falling apart. It's a bit like, you know, sometimes someone won't wake up until it's like, you know, someone says they're divorcing the other. Mm. And it's like, oh my God, it really was a problem.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a shame, because often when we're thinking of storytelling, we hope that the positive storytelling and the affirmative, inspiring storytelling, and there is such a need for that, because fear-based storytelling on its own reaches a sort of a point where it doesn't really work. But I think both are important, because sometimes, like you say, we just do need a little bit of a eureka moment to wake up and go, yeah, if we don't change this, mm-hmm. nobody wins. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And I think that's why, as I mentioned my kiddos a few times, but I do think it does start at home in our own little circles, which used to be much, as you said, much more community-oriented places. You would have, you know, intergenerational communities living in the same space, sharing stories, really understanding not only how things used to be, but how far we've come. And so there has to be that aspect as well of cultivating. And I think this is why so many of us are now looking to Indigenous communities for their wisdom, because this is just ingrained in the way of being. Tyson Yunkaburta, he writes beautifully on this. I think I was hearing that he has a new book that's out. Sand Talk is one of his original, and that was his first novel that he came out with. Just going back to the essence of what it means to be human, because I think the planet eventually will be fine. She knows how to take care of herself. The Earth has seen multiple cycles of, you know, temperature changes, not this extreme. Yeah. This is definitely, you know, an Anthropocene sort of phase, which is human triggered, planet will be fine. But the question is, are we ready to face a world where our kids and the generations are living in much more anguish up until then? And I think the work that I do in my day-to-day and that many of us do in climate on the investing side is because we see, and you know, our portfolio is a living, breathing example of this. Across the world, 18 different funds, again, you know, the broader pipeline is more than 200. They're on the ground, they're supporting solutions that are in water, in agriculture, nature and biodiversity, renewable energy, sustainable ag, the whole spectrum. You know, there are amazing innovators all over the world coming up with the solutions, advancing, scaling them. And so I believe we have what we need. The tools exist, the analytical approaches exist, and now it's about spurring more will to act and really, and this is why I think activating our whole imagination and the power of possibility through storytelling, but also through evidence is essential to moving capital and moving it well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really inspiring actually to hear about all that work. And it reminds me, it's almost like, you know, in terms of storytelling, it almost needs to be like a combination of those wake up moments of, oh my God, plus the positive stories, because otherwise you can just be in dread. And so, like, you know, just as you were describing it there, I'm thinking, wow, like, you know, I can imagine all these local projects in different places working on different things and, you know, having successes. We need to hear those good stories too, because otherwise, you know, a lot of people are experiencing like climate depression and stuff, you know what I mean? Feeling overwhelmed by the whole thing, you know?
Absolutely. We need a good dose of optimism as well as, pragmatism, just given where things are, and seeing like real talk. We need, just as you have real talk in your own families, we need real talk as a human society right now.
Yeah, wonderful. Thanks so much for joining me. I really appreciate it. And good luck with all the work. It's wonderful.
Thank you so much for having me. And I always appreciate these opportunities just to take a bit of a step back and reflect and think about how far we've come and how far we have to go. And thank you to you and the team for all that you do to bring some of these stories to life. It's been a pleasure to chat today.
Thank you. Thanks so much for listening. If you've got this far, you're really one of the stalwarts. I really appreciate you tuning in and listening every week. I would love for you to subscribe and to get notified of all the other great conversations that we have as they come out each month. And if you've enjoyed anything, please do reach out to Sana and I from today's episode to let us know, either on social media or leave us a review. It's always extremely encouraging and, you know, gives us a little boost to keep going. Thank you.